Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. Our panel discussion on the separation of powers concludes with questions from the audience. Moderator Rachel Blakeman will ask the next question, and the first panelist to answer will be former Fort Wayne Mayor Paul Helmke.
So I'm going to use a couple questions from our good panel, our good guests here who have been sending it to us. So if you have questions, please feel free to text. What should happen if the executive branch refuses to execute?
Mm-hmm. Well, I always raise the example. What if, you know, when Nixon was ordered to turn over the tapes, why did he turn over the tapes? A lot of people said, you know, just take them out, burn them on the lawn. You know, what are you going to do? And you know, if something comes up with President Trump and he doesn't want to follow the court rules, what's going to happen? I mean, that is the recipe for a real constitutional showdown. With Nixon, he backed down, and then he was convinced by some of the Republican legislators, the senators, to resign. So we avoided the clear constitutional confrontation, but it could come again. The famous statement is Andrew Jackson's early on, where the court ordered him to do something and basically said, I'm the president. They can't make me do what they can't make me do what I don't want to do. Where's their army? Where's their troops? Jackson said he was going to do what he's going to do. And then you get the issues, can the president be held in contempt? The way the Constitution is written is that's when the legislative branch is supposed to step in with impeachment proceedings. But given different party alignments in the past or in the present or in the future, that might not happen.
The court's power and authority, the power and authority of courts primarily is on the trust and respect of the public, I think. And I know, I have had times sitting on a bench thinking to myself, what happens if they don't obey an order? Well, of course, we have the contempt power, and that's the other muscle that we have, and I've put a few people in jail for contempt of court over the years. But what court is going to hold a president in contempt? Can they? I don't know. When it's the president of the United States, that's a really difficult issue.
And to me, this is the danger. If the courts, because of criticism from the right, the left, the president, the legislature, whatever, are given less credibility, then then you look at the fourth estate, the media, that being criticized too. That's usually sort of the one branch that's not part of the Constitution, but First Amendment in effect establishes it. If the media is all fake media and the courts are all seen as, pursuing an agenda, what does happen when there's the conflict?
So let's also look at local government, which I had on my list, but then somebody here in the audience also wanted to know, specifically the overlap of the county commissioners, because at county government, we have a structure unlike anyone else in the United States. Indiana is the only state that separates the fiscal body to the county council, and then the county commissioners are over the legislative and executive branch of county government. So let's talk about that. Who would like to jump in?
It works so well, right? I used to give talks about local government, and I'd say, the commissioners, the triumvirate, both the executive branch and the legislative branch. The last time it was tried in history was in Rome, and they ended up knifing each other. I guess we haven't done that yet, but the county commissioner system was originally designed with the idea that the commissioners would meet once a month and approve sort of which bridge project or road project was going to be done, and that was going to be it. I still remember I was sitting in the vote when the county council approved making the commissioners full-time. Carl Sudoff was I think president of the county council. I was sitting next to Carl as the attorney, and I said, Carl, are you sure you want to go ahead with this to make the commissioners full-time? And they had been serving full-time. It was more to pay them full-time, but it's just it really is a system. I think we ought to go to a single county manager, or actually I think we ought to merge the city and the county, but if we're going to have a county government, you ought to do something to make it fit the day-to-day sort of challenges that the county faces, not have these three things. When I was mayor, we would basically work with the commissioner who was assigned to Project X, and we'd get them to agree to Project X, and then the other two commissioners wouldn't agree, and so we'd be back at the start. It didn't work. We actually had the county commissioners sue the city when we did the courthouse green project. I mean, love it still when I see the pictures of the courthouse. You got the courthouse green project. The commissioners sued to block the project because it was going to take away some of the sheriff's parking spaces next to the door. And so we went to mediation in Whitley County. And about halfway through the mediation, one of the commissioners came over and sat with us because he wasn't being able to convince the other two to agree with him. So it's an unworkable system. But to me, it's interesting that there are a lot of models to look at in history and local government, state government on how to separate powers. And sometimes we learn from them and do things. At the federal level, I mean, the Montesquieu quote's great, but the system that we established after the Revolution was the Articles of Confederation that had basically all it had was the legislative branch. It didn't have a court, and the president was just the Speaker of the House or the President of the Senate. And that we had that for 9 years. It didn't work. And then they went back and created this: take the power away from the legislative branch, give some to an executive, give some to a court.
Right. And then also, there was a ballot initiative probably about 2 or 3 years ago for Allen County voters to decide if they wanted to consolidate into a single county executive. That went down in resounding defeat. So some of you probably had yard signs for or against that in your yard. And it's just been very interesting to see how Indiana is particularly resistant to changing the structure of government. So as they always say, I mean, when the Kernan Shepherd report was issued, what, like 10 years ago now, we can't keep governing like this. Oh, well, actually, we've proved we can. We have a township government set up for us for horses and buggies. So it's just a really puzzling setup. But we very much like a lot of government in Indiana. But Phil could help change that.
Yeah, in 2010, I actually filed the bill that would make Allen County a single county exec and move the legislative functions over to the county council, because right now they're just the fiscal body, as you said. And then also it was put on the ballot a couple years ago and not only defeated handily, but in the county areas, but also within the city, which I found to be kind of interesting too. There were, excuse me, city precincts that also voted against doing that. So I don't know if it's just, Paul, if it's just something that folks want to be able to vote for their own county commissioner instead of just one, if they feel like they're losing representation. Those are the things that I heard as to why folks voted no.
Yeah, and I just think it's an interesting exercise because when we look at county government as compared to city government, and I always think the example of the police chief and the sheriff. So the sheriff is elected and the police chief is appointed. And it's just a really interesting dynamic, especially if you've worked in or with local government, you've seen how that works. I mean, the fact that we have a unified 911 system is actually a fairly remarkable achievement that went on. I was looking back in records when that was happening, and the initial conversation happened in 1975. So it was before I was born. And it was implemented, I think, in like 2008, 2009-ish. So it's been, we move slowly in some times. Do we think also the separation of powers works well for keeping government slow? Is there an advantage of not having a lot of activity?
Well, and that is the reason we do it. Well, you don't want to concentrate power because while power might be used wisely, it might be used unwisely. And so we set up a system of government that is deliberately inefficient. And we've done that at all levels, pretty much. Again, city government works probably the best of the systems I'm familiar with. The question is that when you get a national crisis, you need to move quickly. When you get a local crisis, you need to be able to move quickly. And so a lot of government isn't just the way it's written in the Constitution or in the statutes. It's sort of the ways that people interact with each other, how they get things done. And really, I think that's one of the crucial issues, too. I was looking at, again, cases that one of the classic cases on separation of powers is the Youngstown Steel case from the late 40s. President Truman wanted to take over a steel mill, basically, and say national crisis. It goes all the way to the Supreme Court. They say that he's gone too far. But they basically set out a rule that the president's power is strongest when Congress specifically gives the president authority to do something. The president's power is weakest when Congress specifically says the president can't do something. And then there's the middle ground where the Congress hasn't said anything at all, but the president, you know, so then the president may or may not step in, and that's where the courts, I guess, get the messy situation. But part of that decision also talks about, and this is sort of in contrast to that Morrison v. Olson decision, they talk about how there's a lot of unofficial ways of doing things, and that while the branches are separate in their own lanes, the branches are required to work together to make the system overall work. And that's why they kind of put that three-part test. And, you know, that's what I worry about with at local level, state level, national level. If you don't get people, and these are all real people in all these slots, if you don't get people that are willing to work together, figure out a way, following the rules to make the system work, then you know that we're not guaranteed to have this system. So,
Judge Cherry, do you want to talk about about the judiciary and how it slows things down, and if that's a good thing or not?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by how it slows things down. What things?
Well, so the idea is that if you're going to
travel ban,
right? Well, so that way it has to go through. So the judicial process, you start at the district court, then you work your way. I mean, it just. Anybody who's been through a lawsuit, for all of these lawyers who have clients, your client wants resolution yesterday,
right,
and you're telling
right.
them you've got 18 months.
Right. There's a tension there that will always be there, you know. These major cases take years to get up to the U.S. Supreme Court and get resolved. And sometimes time is of the essence, but yet the court system, from the perception or view of the general public, works slow. And I think that's probably more benefit to that than not.
Why?
Why? Mm-hmm. Time for cooler heads to prevail, time for getting a little clearer perspective of the issues.
The idea that the problems always look better in the morning.
Yeah.
I'm curious to see how Phil responds to this. One of my concerns with the legislative branch becoming dysfunctional is that it seems to me that at both the federal level, at the national level and the state level, I don't think we have this problem at the local level, instead of decisions being debated on the floor of Congress or the floor of the legislature, they're debated inside the caucus rooms. And that we, rather than have a, you know, so at the, anymore, it's the majority, you need the majority to reach a decision. The minority is basically ignored totally. And then the minority of the majority is pretty much told to follow suit or they're going to get primary. And so we make decisions in secret, and we make decisions that don't really respond to the representatives, regardless of gerrymandering or not, that respond to the folks that the people have elected. Is that your sense at the state?
Yeah.
Do you feel a part of any of the decision making at all?
Remember, I'm giving you a ride.
I know. Okay.
After the,
I'm setting you up.
Oh, okay.
It's not your fault.
Yeah. See, no. That's right. Okay.
well, I think, and that was really one of the main problems that happened toward the end of this session, was there was a lot of back and forth going on between, obviously, the House conferees and Senate conferees. But they also had to take back the conference committee report to their caucus, and either they approve it or they want something, take it out, and then you have to reprint things, and that really does slow the process down. But you're right, it takes the public out of the public debate when these things are being decided behind closed doors like that. And so, no, to answer your question, no, we don't really feel like we're being part of the process. And now that will occur more gradually as the numbers, as the difference in between 70-30 goes down to 55-45 or something like that. But at this point, no, you're pretty much kind of shut out of a lot of that process.
With that said, thank you very much to our three panelists, and thank you to the audience.
This has been an episode of WBOI Presents. If you missed a portion of tonight's episode, the full panel discussion can be found on our website at WBOI.org. Our theme music is by Mark Waldick. Folktales is next. Have a wonderful night.